When you find that you feel uncomfortable with yourself, your friends aren't coming, all the things that you fear will happen. Hair falls out, I don't look as nice, I'm losing weight. It scares my friends to look at me because they know they may get cancer and all the things that start going through everyone's head. I truly feel, however, at the bottom of all this is fear. That if I'm dealing with an individual who is fearful, then yeah, people are going to stay away from that person. Doesn't matter how good or bad they look. When you meet somebody who's at peace with what they're going through, then people don't run away. The first few people I began to work with in the groups, I was amazed at how good they looked and how often people complimented them, even when they'd lost 50 pounds, you know, and didn't really look good. But I realized what they were saying is, you're at peace. You do look good. You kind of glow, even though you're a bag of bones kind of thing. And so I think that, number one, if you want to keep people around you, learn to deal with your fears and to be honest and open and let them deal with theirs. Now, you'll have some who can't handle the fact that you have cancer. It's what I call even reading the greeting cards, you know, the kinds that you get in the hospital that say, we really care about you, but we're off for a month to the Bahamas, and when we get back, we'll give you a ring. Those are people who say, ooh, I'm scared. I can't come. And I'd say it's okay to tell those people, if you can't handle it, it's all right, that there are some people who can't handle it, but we're not judging you. I understand. And not to be hurt by that. And then there are others who you can be an example for and who will come and who will share. And most of all, that nobody's untouched. So don't be afraid to share your troubles because you'll help people share theirs and to really resolve troubles on both sides. The other gets back to the self-esteem. You know, when your hair falls out, are you going down the drain or are you uncovering yourself as a whole person and what you're worth and what you have to deal with? Take a look at yourself naked in the mirror and say, is that human being lovable? The thoughts that come up, are they self-destructive? And stop and admire your smile and your soft skin and your eyes and rebuild yourself and put yourself together. And when there is self-love and self-esteem, then it is easier to relate to the world and it's less fearful going out and all the things that enter into it. But if you're going to try to put on a performance and act like nothing is different, you're going to wear yourself out and stop really communicating with people. I'd let the people who you need know that you need them. Because in letter after letter I get from people, one was a social worker whose husband had cancer, she said, I let all the people know what we needed and I just never knew how much love was available from all of these people. And she said things like, you know, I wore fuzzy clothing, hugged my cat, got a therapist, tried to eat nutritious foods, but sometimes only chocolate tasted good. And I said to her, I can tell you how to eat chocolate without any troubles, any ill effects. And she said, how do you do that? I said, you break the bar and hold the broken edges down so the calories run out, and then you visualize celery as you eat the rest of the chocolate and you'll have no trouble. People are understanding, really, that there are ways, and you can give them lists that say how to protect yourself, how to deal with all these issues and adversity. But the love is out there, and when you realize that, you can ask for it. And I think when people are close to you, and I'm not saying I'm any better at this than anyone else, but when someone in your family isn't well, we get frustrated like doctors with the fact that we can't cure them. So we either say, oh, you're terrific, you'll be fine, which depresses them even more, and get into that more in a minute. Or we say, oh, you'll be cured, you'll be okay, everything will work out. What the person with the illness needs to know is, it's okay to express your feelings, but when you're done, say to that person, hold me. That will make them feel better because they're doing something and you feel better. But the other thing that I see happening in a lot of families is this, what I call balance. For instance, a lady came into the operating room one day that I was going to operate on. She was scared, you know, quotes, to death. And she looked around the room and to reassure herself said, oh, thank God, all you wonderful people are taking care of me. And I leaned over and I said to her, I want to tell you something. I know all these people. They're not wonderful. And she looked at me for a moment, wide-eyed, and then burst out in this big grin, and the panic was gone. See? Now, had I said to her, oh, everybody here is wonderful, everybody's terrific, she would have remained scared to death. And so when you go home, and the individual with the illness says, I don't think I'm going to make it through an hour. And you say, oh, no, you're wonderful. Everything's fine. They'll say, maybe a half hour. Because there's got to be a balance. So if you have the pessimist, you'll have the optimist in the house. But if everybody can face reality, then you all can be on a level keel. You just cannot go around being the total optimist. The sun is always shining. Everything's wonderful. Or you're going to destroy somebody else in the household because they're going to have to balance you. And the same is true if you're the eternal pessimist. Somebody else is going to have to balance you. So give everybody an opportunity to say, this is reality. It is scary. There are problems associated with it. But there is hope and there are things that we can do. Then the whole household is an awful lot healthier. Otherwise, the communication falls apart. The problem I see is getting people to live. Now, maybe that's because I'm the surgeon. That's a little more dramatic in the sense that, again, at a meeting with a psychotherapist, I once said to him, it was Larry Lachan, that I see a lot of people who want to die. And he was kind of shocked. I said, well, wait a minute. You wrote a book called You Can Fight for Your Life. Who's going to walk in your office? Somebody who wants to die? No. So I think many psychotherapists see people who have made a commitment to live. I don't. So my first step is that the message is love yourself, not eat the right food, diet, exercise, and don't smoke, but love yourself. I mean, if people love themselves, we wouldn't be passing laws about seat belts and struggling to get smoking stopped and a whole host of other poisons that are used. So my issue is love yourself. Now, if you come in and say, well, I've learned to love myself, then I say, step two, this is what's good for you, now that you love yourself, you see. Moving towards vegetarianism, if you want to get more specific. Moving in a certain way in terms of your diet, leaving out red meats, caffeine, salt, sugar. I mean, what things can be destructive for me? What would be good for my disease? Is exercise appropriate? All of these things. Humor, acting childlike, bringing fun back into my life, games, playing. All of these things that we can literally write down and line up for people, but who are not going to do them unless they like living. And so I keep bouncing up and back with that. And where I truly probably emphasize the details less, it doesn't mean that in our ECAP groups we don't have some good health food vitamins, quality vitamins for people, because I suggest they take vitamins and they take supplements in certain amounts so that they know they're not insufficient in anything and that they change dietary habits. But I'm not criticizing them for it. And I'm not yelling, why aren't you doing that? Because if I do, and particularly even back to family, saying, why are you doing this and why are you doing that, then the communication stops. They don't want to see each other. But a medical student one day said to me, you know, some of the patients who smoke, when you walk around, I don't see them hiding their cigarettes when you come in the room. I said, because my message is love yourself, and they don't have to hide what they're doing. I say to them, I love you. I hope someday you'll love yourself. I don't say, you terrible person, look what you're doing to yourself. And that's the difference. So they can be comfortable with me, with their weaknesses and their pain and even their guilt, in a sense, because I don't make them feel worse about it. And I think that's the difference. And so when you say, I'm open to this, and you experience it, it doesn't matter what your neighbor thinks of you. If you want to be liked, you're in trouble. Jesus said we should love each other. And Martin Luther King Jr. said it's a good thing Jesus told us to love each other, not like each other, because there are some people you can't like. You need to love yourself. There may be things about you that are not likable. Forgive yourself. But if you love yourself, develop self-worth, develop self-esteem, you can live a very interesting life. When you're worrying about what the neighbors think, what other doctors think, you're in big trouble. And so I really don't worry about what they think. I'm out there to help. I mean, I'm obviously not, you know, out there to hurt people and say, I don't care what you think. I'm out there to love and help and live my life. And so my comment is, live the message. What the Quakers say is, speak truth to power. That's my line. I go out and live the truth. Nobody can ever say I didn't experience something. Nobody can ever say I'm lying about anything. I live it and I speak it, and the world changes because of it. So if I shift the center of the world a little bit, I really feel like I've done something. And what I also know is, see, what protects me is, at an intuitive, unconscious level, every human being knows that what I'm saying is true, or the ripples wouldn't have gone out around this planet already. I tell people they can communicate with their body literally by talking to it, by visualizing things happening in it, and also through your emotions and feelings. And so the body responds. And when you say, how do I focus my mind? I say, well, let's use all three of those things. I mean, we've talked a lot about how you deal with your life and your feelings. How do you focus down even further? The body will respond to images and visions. For instance, if you said, I'm lying on a beach in the sun, you might find your hands warm up. You might also find they got cold. And then I say, why do you think that happened? You say, well, one of my children drowned at the beach. So you're going to react to that image in your body as well. And we have also found that when patients were told the night before surgery, a simple bit of instructions, like tell your body to move the blood away from where we're going to operate, when you measured blood loss in the operating room, it was half as much in those who were given those simple instructions as those who were not. So you find talking to your body works. And sometime, again, I do this on a simple level. When your hands are cold outside, say to your body, I want more blood in my hands, I'm cold. And watch what happens. You can show people really simple biofeedback. If they hold a thermometer in their hand or a little mechanism that'll beep in their hands and visualize their hand getting warm, the temperature goes up and it gives them a sense of control. And so those are the things I'd like everybody to work with. I just got a letter that I read last night, a lady who was sent home to die of diffuse metastatic lung cancer. And her husband called up a friend who's a doctor, and she said, oh, no, I won't accept what they're all telling her. And she said, I'm coming over. And she came over. I wish I had brought the letter with me. And she sat down with her, and they started playing some quiet music, and she said, look, I want you to visualize your lungs, and I want you to see them becoming clean and Pac-Man going through and eating up the cancer. And she started doing these sessions with her several times a day. Lo and behold, that lady's lungs are free of disease today. The doctor calls it a miracle. He doesn't know why it happened. And here we are back again. See, I don't know why it happened. Maybe it's a spontaneous remission. Why don't they ask the lady, what did you do? What happened when I sent you home to die? And then she'd say, well, I called up another friend of mine who is a doctor who said, no, we're going to use all these techniques and you're going to communicate with your body. If you're going to feel like a failure, you see, if your lungs didn't clear up, then I guess I didn't do it right. And I see people like that who say, I will do the imagery, but I'm not seeing the right things, or it didn't work, or I guess I've done it wrong, or I didn't do it 6 times yesterday. I say, forget it, stop. Because one of the things on my list is to interrupt your day 4 to 6 times to do imagery, meditation, or quiet music, or prayer. In other words, times that restore you and make you feel good. Because I just mentioned 3 things. If you feel good, your body will work at healing. Yes, it's nice to add the verbal and visual stimulation to those sessions and to do all of them. Because I think that can tell your body there are certain areas I want to focus on to heal. And what you can begin to do also as you begin to understand which images are more productive is to help people create the appropriate ones, whether it's controlling blood supply, immune system, sending treatment to certain places, healing faster, all these things can go together. And that the mind is incredible. And I think we are just beginning to understand the incredible powers we have within our bodies and how wonderful these things are. I get excited as a surgeon. I mean, lots of times students, as we make rounds at night, and you meet people who have major surgery, and they're sitting up with no pain, some of them making beds of other people in the room, and I say, what are you doing? We just operate on you. And they say, what do you mean? I feel fine. Why should I lie in bed? And I walk out, students say, well, what are you so excited about? I say, why am I excited? Look what the human body is capable of, and look what the mind can do. And they say, but I know that's what you're teaching us, so why are you excited? Because I'm seeing it day after day and night after night. And that's why I think as a surgeon, I'm affected very differently by it. I mean, I see it so dramatically in the people I'm working with. And I find it is exciting. And it does encourage me to keep teaching this and, you know, having us carry it on further and further. I think that many of us misinterpret what relaxation is. I see it at a deeper level, not just distracting you. I'm not saying that there aren't times I want to be distracted and sit down in front of the television set, but that's not frequent with my schedule. But most of the time, to me, I'm talking about relaxation, meditation, auto-hypnosis. I'm talking about something on a deeper level. It's really opening the door to that unconscious and letting out things that normally might only come out in your sleep, but to let them out at other times so that you can be aware of them and use them. And it's a much more profound change. You can get into brain waves and a whole host of things, but I'd rather not get scientific for a moment because I don't think that helps people understand. But I think that when we use techniques like guided imagery or certain Baroque musics, that you do change the brain pattern and people get a feeling that's very different. Very peaceful, serene feeling. And they come out of it feeling restored, even if it's just a few moments. For some, prayer does it. For some, just listening to the music does it. But it connects you with something deeper in yourself. And also allows you to experience certain things through the images. For instance, you can meet people who have died. You can, yes, go to the doctor's office. You can meet yourself as a child. You can grow and bloom as a flower. I mean, I go through lots of experiences with people. And it gives them insights in a symbolic way. Let me give you a specific example. If I said to you that in your living room you will find a chest and open it, and there'll be a message for you, you'd say, well, I guess the chest looks like this, and I know what the living room is. But in a trance-like state, you see, your chest can be your chest, and the message from inside can be from your heart. And so to the unconscious, taking the right turn, for instance, doesn't mean turning right. The right turn could be to go to the left. And so the language that you use when you deal with the unconscious is very symbolic and very different. And that brings up things that for people become very profound and meaningful. You know, that when you go beneath the surface, it doesn't mean just looking under the water. It means touching deeper things. You're putting yourself in some trance-like state, but that you're still in control of. Many people start to do this and do panic because they feel like I'm giving up control. But it's you. It's like saying, who's creating your dream? It's coming out of you. That, to me, is another aspect of this whole mystical, faith-like feeling. Who decides what we dream? How does this brain cell and protein create a vision and a dream? To me, that's something I don't think we're ever going to understand. But it's that wonderful nature inside of us that says, this is you, here you are. My dreams have been very helpful to me, telling me at appropriate times, you know, what to do and how to guide myself. And I think we all need to pay attention. God speaks in dreams and images. That comes out of the Bible, not me. And I think that when we learn that, we listen to that inner voice, whatever God means to any individual, whether it's just the creative force or whatever, we learn something more about ourselves. And I think that's why the meditation and the images get in touch with something deeper inside ourselves that really is our true essence and our true self. It's like saying that your DNA is your true self, and it's speaking to you through these images. And please pay attention. Also, I have to tell you, one conversation I had with God, I asked God why she used dreams and images instead of flashcards, because my thought was, you see, that if you used flashcards, you'd go to sleep at night, and a card would appear to say, change jobs, take chemotherapy, and you'd wake up in the morning and say, boy, that's easy, I just got a message. And God said, I started to make flashcards, but there were so many languages that it would have taken creation in 8 days instead of 7 days, so I had to give up on the flashcards and use universal symbols. And that's when you begin to understand through our myths and through our dreams that we're all alike and the messages are the same for each of us. One of the things that I learned is that not everybody is a visual person. I happen to be visual. I'm an artist also. And if you listen to this tape, you'll find that there many times I will say, do you see what I'm talking about? But there are people who are visual, auditory, tactile, olfactory. In other words, we use different senses. I have a professional musician comes to the workshop. He says, I can hear a piece, but I can't see what you're talking about. And so I will say to people that you get in touch with things, you see things, you smell things, you feel things, and it helps you. So don't be upset if you're not a visual person, and don't close your eyes and see something. And don't set yourself up for failure. Well, one little boy said, I didn't meditate 3 times a day, but I did 1 and it was good. He's not a failure. He did something positive. The rest of the day, he had a good day. It isn't what he didn't do. It's that he had a wonderful day and therefore forgot to do a meditation. But he was living a full life and didn't need it. But those of us who set ourselves up in a compulsive way, I must meditate, has to be so many minutes, have to meet, have to see, have to this, stop. You may be better off with your music and quiet time and just closing the door and allowing your body to be at rest rather than feel like you failed. I also can suggest that you work with a guided imagery therapist, a hypnotherapist, or art therapist to help you work with your own specific images and guide you in that way. How you discover what's right for you, I'd say, really has to do with putting those symbols down and discussing them. Talk about your dreams. Keep a dream journal. Work with an art therapist or hypnotherapist so that you go over your images, what I call constructively criticizing. A good therapist doesn't look at your drawing and tell you what you should know or do. They allow you to discover what's inside yourself. And there are many good books about dreams that you can purchase that will help guide you and make your dreams productive. I went into drawings because, number one, I'm not a Carl Jung or a mythologist. I don't know everything there is to know about dreams. Now, generally speaking, I have to say, if you work with an individual, you will have the symbolism come out of the dreams. And in discussing it with another person, one technique was to have a friend of yours sit down with you, make believe they're almost like from another planet, and just ask you to keep describing what was in your dream. And in the descriptions, things come out. And you hear keywords, like I would say out of my dreams, that you can't fit everything in, trying to back a truck in, and nobody else would try, and I did, and had an accident. You realize you can't fit everything into your life, or that people are after you, or, you know, the things you start describing, and you suddenly say, oh, wow, I know what that means. When you put it on paper in a drawing, we really have something there to work with and to look at. And it's easier for me, because of my experience with the drawings over 10 or more years, to work with those as well. And so we, under certain conditions, like white paper, a full box of crayons, so you have all the options there, people are asked to draw certain things. Now, it could be draw yourself in the operating room, draw your home and family, draw choices, conflicts, therapy. And then we work to, again, constructively criticize, you see. Doing a good drawing isn't the issue. As we mentioned before, if you did a drawing with no arms, head, or legs, I can say you don't have any head, arms, or legs. You say, oh, I'll put them on. But that doesn't change you. And so what I want to do is turn you from a helpless person with no assets into somebody who suddenly says, I have head, arms, and legs, and I am a whole person, and I can reach out, and I can move, and I can talk and see what's going on. And that's why I find them so powerful. And the other is that they are the creation of the individual. It's you creating something. And I just can say, why do you think you did this? For instance, somebody leaves a nose off. And I can say, well, what is a nose for? And they say, well, you breathe through it. I say, yeah, and in the Bible it says God breathed life into Adam through his nostrils. And maybe when you don't have a nose, it means you need to nurture and love yourself more and breathe in life. And it says something to them, you see, because maybe the no-nose is in the midst of their family and they're not getting enough love in terms of what they're doing, or it may be in a therapeutic setting and there's no life being given to them in that setting. And that, you see, awakens them. Yes. Can they rationalize and say, well, I'm not a good artist and I don't know how to draw noses? That's all right. I don't yell at people and say that's not the reason. But I allow them to discover within themselves why they did certain symbols. And I found it very powerful in my life to do that, my dreams and my drawings, and in the work that I've done with not only our family, some of our children are happy to do drawings and others purposely avoid it so they don't want daddy looking over their shoulder. But when you see these things happen in your own life and you experience them, it's very powerful. And then you guide it. And so one of our children said, I don't know what college to go to. I said, draw yourself at each of these colleges. Because there's past, present, and future in these drawings, too. And so when I looked at his sheet, I said, look, this is where your unconscious is telling you to go to school. And it was. Those were the right choices for him. Now, you could say that's a coincidence, but we've dealt with it enough in our lives to know that this is no coincidence. This is a deep inner knowing that we each of us have because we're creating our future by what we do each day. You listen to this tape today, you're different tomorrow than if you'd gone to a movie. See, you're being changed by what you're choosing to do hour by hour. If some of you are interested in doing a drawing of yourself, I'm going to give you a little information. And I have to say the little information can sometimes be dangerous. But I think if you use it constructively and not to scare yourself, it may be useful. And I would say right now, go out and get a box of crayons, get a piece of white typing paper, hold the page vertically, and draw yourself, your disease, your treatment, and your immune system eliminating the disease. Get that done, then come back to the tape and listen to what I have to say. At this moment, with the drawing in front of you, I'd say take a look at the drawing. It's really no different than saying look at your handwriting. I mean, you have something to learn by what you create. And if you look at the drawing, look at what parts you leave out of your body. For instance, if you didn't have hands or they were hidden, I'd say, do you have trouble reaching for your knees? Or if you said, gee, I ran out of space and I don't have legs, I might say, why are you feeling stuck? Or do you feel like you're growing up out of the earth? Look at the changes. If you didn't have ears, that you didn't want to hear something. Now, this might not apply to a woman who has long hair with her ears covered. So look at all those issues. Do you have great broad shoulders that the world can put their problems on? Are you sticking your neck out? And as you look at your figure, look at what is there, what is shown, sexuality, clothing, all of those things. Then I'd look at the disease. How much of your body does it take up? What color is it? And we'll mention colors later. Your immune system, how does it relate to where the disease is? Does it surround it? Is it animated? Your therapy, are you accepting it into your body or is it off in a corner of the page? Does the IV, if you're getting chemotherapy, stop at your hand so it's as if it isn't coming into your body? And look at, again, the total concept of how you are integrating all these things. Sometimes people have had hundreds of little items on their page and you look at that and you say, how can you be organized and how can you heal when all of these things are going on in your life? So look at the organization, the pattern, your size, how much self-esteem do you have? How much of the page do you fill up? Are you stuck in a corner? Did you have to add a second page because your self-esteem is so good that you don't fit on one page and add another? And we've had people do that. Take a look also at the color you use. And I will give you just a brief understanding of some of the colors. Yellow, for instance, can represent energy. Now, it would be nice if the treatment were yellow, that you're saying, here's sunshine and energy coming into my life. On the other hand, you might worry if the disease were yellow, saying it has a lot of energy. Orange can be symbolic of change. And again, I'd say it's a good color for therapy or for you, because you want to be changed by the treatment and be helped by it. But be careful during times of change, because things can happen to you. Purple is a spiritual color. In general, I feel that this is a positive statement. For instance, if your therapy, again, were purple. If the disease were purple, I might be concerned that it's possessing you and pressuring you to be spiritual and hope you would respond to it in a positive way. Black can mean grief or despair. But again, out of the grief and despair, compressing the carbon leads to diamond. So most people will draw the disease as black or red, which says it leads to grief and despair or it's very emotional for me. But out of that can come positive things. So please don't judge the color as right, wrong, good, or bad. If you dress yourself in black and you happen to be wearing blue today, I'd say there is a lot of grief in your life. Look at it. Deal with it. Red is a color of emotion, and that can range from pain and conflict to passion, and to look at how that comes into your life. Blue, green, and brown are generally natural colors, but you can be lost in a jungle and overgrown by the green. But in a general sense, those colors, if they fill you out in the page, I would be more interested in their intensity and how much of nature and life is in you, and also in terms of the quality of those colors. If you used white on the white piece of paper, I'd ask you what you're covering up. Or if you used gray or pink, I'd say, what are you hiding? Because the paper's already white, and you don't need to use white. So what feelings might you be hiding if you made a lot of snow or try to use white on your white cells? Because you see it doesn't show up, and if you persist, I'd say, what things are you covering up? Gray and pink represent covering up of black and red. It's like layering white on top of black and on top of red, so you get gray and pink. And then I'd say, what despair are you hiding? What emotion are you hiding? And then look at it in a total context, as I said. This is a personal statement. It is to help change you. If you couldn't change, there'd be no point in doing drawing. So what you see today can be turned around. Just as one lady I knew years ago drew herself on a tightrope headed downhill in a very precarious position, a later drawing showed her climbing a ladder back up over a fence into life again, and she's still alive years later. So some pretty desperate-looking pictures change and turn around, and some good things can happen. So use this to change you. That's what this is about. You're not grading yourself. It's what do I see? How can I help change myself? How can I help heal my life? Because, again, nothing's right or wrong. I want that understood, you see. It's not good, bad, right, or wrong, that if I don't draw a nose, it's bad. If I use black, it means this, and red means that. This is knowledge coming out, say. For instance, you could say, well, black could mean grief and despair. And I say, that's right. But if you squeeze the carbon, you come up with a diamond. So if you're willing to face your grief and despair, something wonderful can happen in your life. And that's why I say don't judge the drawing. Once you give people that information, yeah, they can sit in little groups, little families, and work with each other's drawings and learn from each other. And the same is true at home, that some of my patients have journals of drawings that every few months or even weeks they will redraw themselves and different things. Now, you might say, well, of course, if they know, they can deceive you. They'll pick up a different color. We don't set out to deceive. We're using this therapeutically. And it's amazing what the unconscious does, because I have set out to deceive when I've done drawings in groups. It's like saying, well, I'll make sure all my family is holding hands and everybody will know we're very close and communicating. And then 15 minutes later, I look at the drawing and we're not holding hands. And I say, how did that happen? But something stops the crayon and there's that little space that appears. Now, I could have 15 minutes later looked at the drawing and said, I'll correct it and touch everything. Yes. But who are you deceiving? You have discovered something. And the patients I work with who do this type of journal drawings are doing it to learn and don't set out to deceive. We've talked about the psychological aspects. I have made physical diagnoses from these because the body speaks not only in your dreams but through these images. And so I've looked at some drawings and made a physical diagnosis. My wife is always saying, remind them you do x-rays and other blood tests. The question in this gentleman's case was, did he have an obstructed liver? And was it inside the liver or outside? Was it medical or surgical? And I asked him to just draw pictures. I don't tell people necessarily what to draw. Sometimes I will if I want directed help. And he handed me a drawing of a tree, and it was an amazing tree because the little branches were all very tiny and distorted, and then the trunk was wide open and open into the ground. I mean, it wasn't like a root system. It was like a T shape. It ran open into the ground. And I looked at that, and I said, those are his bile ducts. They're open. The problem is in the liver, in those little squinched-up ducts. And sure enough, that was the problem. But I look at that, and I know. And in another instance, a woman also happened to draw a tree. She came to me because she had cancer of the breast. And her mother and sister had cancer, and her mother had died of it, of the breast. And she said, I have a small cancer. I don't know whether to have a lumpectomy, mastectomy. I don't know what choice to fulfill. I said, draw some pictures. Again, one of them was a tree. Every branch on the tree was cut off like 90 degrees, the way you prune a bush. And I looked at that, and I thought to myself, her unconscious is saying that there are times you have to prune the bush to live and to stay healthy, and that it really was saying a mastectomy is right for her. And I shared that with her, which ultimately became her choice. A choice, again, you see, of a healing, not of an assault or mutilation. So here's a lady who went through a mastectomy and saw it as a healing experience because of this message that came from within her to do that, not the surgeon telling her what to do. And that's where those symbols can work physically as well, very, very powerfully. One of the things that survivors notice about themselves, I think, is that they can respond to the situation, that someone you think is incredibly serious suddenly acts childlike. And you are surprised by that individual. But that's the survivor personality. They fit into what is occurring at the moment. So in the midst of sometimes the most horrendous, difficult things, well, example, in the hospital, there are many times I'm in a room with an individual who's critically ill, and they're smiling and I'm smiling when we're done. And people say they must be denying, but we're not denying. We're actually having a good time. We're back to that we're either alive or dead, not living or dying. And these are people who are alive. And even though the chart may say so-and-so's critical and terminal and dying, the person's alive, that survivor personality in them. They can see humor in the moment. If they need to be serious, they can be. And they're ready to shift and fit in. Now, many of these people have difficulty having lots of friends because the interesting thing is they may have several close friends, but they don't need people. They can do things on their own. And people find it difficult to know exactly who they are and what they're like because they're changing. And the key is that they're not worried about whether they're liked or disliked. They're not performing for their friends. They're living their life. And people then either accept them or don't on that level. So it's just like saying the good patient is the one that the nurse and the doctor have problems with. If I hear complaints about you from the head nurse, they say, good, you're going to live longer. I'd say the same thing in terms of this survivor personality. They said, gee, he acts differently at different times. I'd say good that he's fitting in with the occasion, with his feelings, with the way he should respond to life. People can learn to be survivors if they're willing to. That's part of why I write and talk, that sure, we can just give you a list and say, do this, do that. If you like living, you'll follow the list. I think we're all capable of it. In the movie Harold and Maude, which Ruth Gordon was in, she's asked as an elderly woman, how come she's so good with people? And she said, they're my species, you know. And I think that if you remember the species, you're capable of being a survivor and of changing. Now, whether you have the courage and the desire to do that is a whole other issue. And again, that gets back to what your parents are like, what they taught you. If you've been programmed properly, then it's easy. If you haven't been, it's a lot of work to get rid of those old messages and go on in a very different way. I think that most of us choose comfort because we don't want to change. And again, the sadness is you learn you're going to die, and then you say, I'm sorry I didn't change and live my life. And it's something I'm constantly bringing up to people, that it's a lot easier to let go of the tree of life if you've had a moment of living and showing your beauty and color. And that's what we need to awaken to. But when everybody else is saying, fit in, be liked, don't act different, it's very hard. And I think that the only way to know you're growing or changing is that things are uncomfortable at that moment. I've had periods of what I call happy depressions. Now, it may sound crazy, but what I mean by that is when things are disturbing me, affecting me, and I'm feeling it, I'm at the same time happy that I'm not feeling okay, because I know this is leading me to look at issues that I'm vulnerable to and look at feelings that have come up and change, so that the next time that happens, I won't be vulnerable. And if people are willing to deal with their distress and discomfort, they'll grow and change. If they decide to go take a Valium or have a drink or quit, get busy so you don't pay attention to your feelings, then you may never change and grow. At some point, I think all of us will be very sorry if we haven't lived at the moment we die. How you rid yourself of things you don't like or how you change, I think has to do with your openness and willingness, again, to change. Number one, I could say go to a therapist and keep talking, because a big part of the change I see in people is providing them with a good listener, whether it's a group or a therapist, that if you listen to people, they get their pain out, they begin to understand it, and they really begin to change without ever saying you must do this, this, and this. It's almost integrated into the sharing. And I think they probably hear themselves for the first time and what they've lived through, and then can go home and understand and begin to change. Another part, I would say, is simply work. You know, that it can mean things like keeping the journal, reading books about self-change. I like to read little daily words and messages that kind of program you for each day. One, I remember the other day that Woody Allen said, each day is filled with pitfalls and opportunities, and our job is to avoid the pitfalls, seize the opportunities, and be home by 6 o'clock. And I think that it's laughing a little, looking at these things, accomplishing things each day, most of all being willing to deal with the distress and confront it. The other could also be, obviously, forgiving your parents, you know, and not blaming them for all the things that you're still doing. And very often when we get angry at other people, it is because of what we don't like about ourselves. And I'd say use that. And when you find yourself flaring up, think about, why are you disturbed? What is bothering you? And how can this make me aware of what I'm doing in my life? Because you're no longer, and this I think you have to emphasize, you are not that child anymore. You are an adult now. You're not that kid. And you don't have to behave that way. You have a free choice about what you do. And if you're going to blame anybody for your behavior, blame yourself. It's when you're threatened, when you know your life may end, that you suddenly stop and look and say, but was it real? Was it my life? Have I done anything? And those are questions people are always asking themselves. And the sad part is, I'd say for the majority of us, we have never done anything real. Again, Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss. If you climb the ladder of success, you'll get to the top and it's leaning against the wrong wall. And that's where most people are. So I follow my happiness, because I know that I'll end up with enough money if I do what makes me feel good. And I think that's the important part, and it really is true. The happiest people I see are the people who are choosing to love, not working at getting a bigger salary. And that's, I think, why we're all here. And interestingly enough, too, if you do a few hours of volunteer work a week, you will have fewer illnesses and live longer. And again, it gets back to bringing some meaning and sense into your life of what we're all here for. And I think that's really what it's about. When you go to countries where people regularly live to be 100, some of their toasts are to your 300th birthday, so kids growing up projecting that it's okay. They know that if you get older, you're still respected, and they do have that saying, yesterday's gone, tomorrow isn't here, so what is there to worry about? And I think that's the way you want kids to grow up. I often repeat the word moment, living in the moment, and I should tell you how to get to heaven without dying. I frequently visit in heaven, and usually when we're doing a workshop, I say to people, what are the three basic differences between heaven and earth? And those who haven't visited don't know, but the three basic differences are lovely view, great weather, and no time. And you cannot duplicate the view and the weather down here, but you can get people to live in the moment. And if you live in the moment, you'll be in heaven your whole life, because every moment you are all right. And you begin to realize how many moments you can get through when you just take it right now. And this is why. I remember one family called me up. They said, we came running because Joan called us and said she's dying. She's ready to die. This is a lady who had breast cancer, incredible fighter, years later developed leukemia as a side effect of therapy and just said, I don't want to go through this whole process again. It's okay to die. So she called her family, and they came running. And they called me up to say, this is ridiculous. I've never seen her looking so well. And I said, I have to explain to you that when you say no more treatment, it's okay to die, it's an unburdening. She does look terrific. I said, if she has a miracle and gets better, wonderful. But if not, this is why she looks so well. And they were all upset, come from all over the country, expecting to see this person, you know, 5 minutes from death. That's why I see lots of little miracles and little remissions. When people say, I'm ready to die, they often feel too good to die at that moment because they then are free to say and do what they want and often will go on for a few months and then say, okay, now I've completed all my business, I can go. So knowing you're going to die and living in that way really frees you to live now. And most people, as I said, are saying someday my day will come, and it may never come. I mean, it's hard for me to stop talking because I keep thinking of all these people sitting there with cancer. One lady, husband has a heart attack and dies. She develops breast cancer, falls in love with another guy, says, well, we can't get married because it won't look good to the neighbors. So they wait a year. They get married and he's killed in an accident. See? And then she says, my God, we wasted a year of our lives that we could have spent together. And that's what I keep saying to people. Live your life now. Don't waste it. Don't wait till it looks nice for the neighbors. Live now. And in living now is how you accomplish something. When you look at how you balance your life, how you balance your goals, you really have to ask yourself why you are here and what is your role. It is the feeling, I think, of entrapment that leads us to trouble. That years ago, when the government looked for the carcinogen in the kitchen because housewives have more cancer than women who work, they found that domestic help has less cancer than the housewife. So obviously it isn't the carcinogen in the kitchen in a chemical sense, but what it feels like to be trapped as a housewife. So whether you're working at home or working outside the house isn't the problem. If you're feeling trapped, you're vulnerable and it's a problem. And I think that's where you have to look at your life and say, what are my goals? How do I want to contribute? Contributing as a housewife is fine. Contributing outside the house is also fine. I think women are more vulnerable because perhaps they tend, in many cases, to be less assertive or limited in terms of their roles and what they can do. But if it's killing you to be what you are, then obviously I'd say speak up and change. Because what you're doing is denying everybody in your family something. And that when you begin to live your life, they all benefit. And I see this a great deal when people do learn they're mortal, go home and say to the rest of the family, that's your problem, I can't take care of that anymore. Then everybody gets angry. But ultimately, a few months later, you meet them and they're all better off. And they're all thanking the individual for teaching them how to deal with their problems, their life. Everybody, you see, is there to love. Because what I think has to be behind this is, how do I contribute love to the world? That's what you have to figure out. Whether you do it as the elevator operator, subway conductor, waiter, doctor is not the issue. But the underlying issue is, how do I contribute to love? If you have found the occupation that allows you to contribute love, you'll be perfectly happy and have enough to survive on. And if you haven't, you'll be perfectly unhappy, and all the other things aren't going to solve it for you. And I think once you begin to do that, you just find more and more ways to give and contribute to the world. I look at my life as an example. I mean, I set out 10 years ago to have 8 group meetings with a dozen people to help them live between office visits. And here I am, 10 years later, making tapes for tens of thousands and maybe millions of people, or being on television or writing books or getting letters from all over the world. Why? Because I decided I'd like to help some people. I didn't ask for any of this. It kind of comes to you and out of you when you choose to love. the spirituality, the belief, you might say, in the essence of love and intelligence is there for all of us. When you listen to people who are close to death say, I see it all. It's all just endless love. And look at the light. And then they die, looking at that light. It leaves everybody in that room with a different feeling, like there's something else going on here, that they have seen the truth and they have shared it with us. I think Dostoevsky said, I have seen the truth, I have seen it. In one moment, everything could be corrected at once. The chief thing is to love. And when you make that realization that the chief thing is to love, everything is changed at once. Too many people only realize it on their deathbed when they look up and say, I love and I see the light. And then they're gone. And it would be nice if we could see the light and love way before that and understand it's there. It doesn't mean that you're going to be treated nicely, that you say, okay, this tape's terrific, I'm going out and I'm going to love. And you're driving along in your car, as I was, and you pull up behind a car that says, honk if you love Jesus. And you gently honk, and the guy turns around and gives you an obscene gesture. And then you begin to realize that the reason you go out and love isn't because everybody's going to turn around and love you back, but it's because of what it does for you to love. And that's the important part to remember. When you ask where or how to develop a sense of faith, or even where my faith comes from, I just say, as a scientist, take a look at the universe. It is very mystical. How did all of this begin? Talk to astronomers, talk to quantum physicists, and you really begin to understand that there's a mysticism. Just read some of Einstein's work, sense of awe and wonder. So I think part of the faith can come from really looking around you and stop thinking that you have answers to everything and know how everything began. Beyond that, I think that if one is willing, as I said, to live and to be aware of this intuitive, wonderful knowledge that lies within us, understanding what the collective unconscious is like, our myths, our symbols, how much we share with each other, the fact that I can go anywhere on this planet with a box of crayons and interpret people's drawings means we've all had a common source of origin because we share. You know, that the color purple means the same at an unconscious level to each one of us, and so do certain symbols. And so to me, I see this unity around us, and I really think that the universe was created for love, to reflect it, to reveal it, that it's meaningless if free choice isn't given, so it also opens us to danger. But I think out of this comes my sense of faith, that we're here for a reason, that we're headed in a direction. It doesn't mean we couldn't destroy this planet. I mean that there are some killers out there who are capable of doing it. But that if enough of us love, we will heal and change all of those around us. And I think if we all love the next generation, that would be done very quickly. But I think when you stop and question scientifically, that you don't have to have religion behind you to have faith, that there is something behind all of this. And I don't mean some old man or woman sitting up there saying, okay, I created the universe and I'm God, but that by my definition, energy is loving and intelligent. I rely on the intelligence and love of the energy within me to resist illness and help me survive every day, just as in a sense we rely on the earth turning and the sun coming up tomorrow. Something out there that has this all held together. Mankind has never died of any disease. It has never wiped us out. We all have this ability within us to resist and fight and go on and overcome. There are a lot of survival mechanisms, and to me this is all a part of my faith. And also, I say as a deep level, that there is a meaning behind all of this. Some of the meaning is in the experience in living and loving and trying to create that kind of total love, ultimately, that I think we're all capable of. When you watch a family in which someone is ill, you begin to understand why I say that everyone has the disease when it strikes one member of the family. And it's everybody living an experience. Too often, as a matter of fact, we as physicians focus on the person with the illness and forget the rest of the family and forget what the children are going through or even going to school talking about cancer and then saying my mother has it or AIDS or any other. You know, can you touch? Can you eat? Can you kiss? Can you hug? I mean, a lot of simple things that go on, as well as all the fears that they're having. You know, a child may say, if my mother dies, who's going to dress me in the morning? And you might say, well, grandma will come over. And they may say, okay, fine. That resolves that problem. So it's at all levels, from the simplest to the most complex. When somebody says, I'm supposed to live my whole life with someone and then they die, what do I do now? And if you get the entire family to come together to share, obviously they can heal each other. But more importantly, we're not just saying to the person with the illness, here's your list of how to live and heal your life, and we ignore everybody else. I think that list has to be shared with everybody in the family. So when the person with the illness may say, look, I'm going to meditate for 15 minutes, dinner will have to wait, the others can say, well, we love you, we'll set the table and make dinner. Or they can say, okay, we'll all meditate now for 15 minutes and then we'll all get together and do. So it isn't your needs have to be met and mine don't. And I do see families where the illness becomes an incredibly manipulative tool. One lady came into my office. She said, I got all kinds of troubles. I'm very, very sick. I said, I know how to help you. She said, how? I said, I know you live in a housing project for the elderly. Go back there, go through the project, find somebody sicker with more troubles and make them feel better. Give them some love. Watch what it does for you. 2 weeks later, she came back for her visit, and I said, well, what happened? She said, I went through the whole building. There's nobody sicker with more troubles in the whole project than me. I'm never going to take her disease away because I think she relates to the world through her disease. And that's what I would hate to see happen in a family. I would like them to relate to each other as people, to share, to love, to not feel guilt. It doesn't mean you don't have grief if that person dies, but that you have shared what you need to share. And the truth is that if someone is lost who has loved and the family has shared that love, they go on. They're sustained by what they experienced and they keep living because they will not buckle into adversity when the individual who they lived with didn't. And I visit homes and I see the warmth and the love that goes on there in the midst of that illness. It doesn't mean they may not get angry and make noise and share, but that's the important part, that it's all out in the open, all resolved, all dealt with. They're human beings living together and allowing each other that kind of support. So it means that the wife may have to say, look, I can't take care of you. I need to get help, or I need some time out, and to give each other that freedom. One woman who's handicapped, who's in our groups, feels very guilty because her husband has to help her all the time. I said, why don't you tell him he doesn't have to help you, that he can go out on his own, do something on his own. If he says no, fine, that's his choice, but then you don't have to feel like you're holding him. And those are the things we need to share with each other. And I think when we do that, then the whole family is healed and all the fears are dealt with. When you have to tell your children that you have a very serious illness, or for that matter, when children have to tell their parents. Because what I've seen is a child is a child. I see 80-year-olds who are having difficulty telling their 60-year-old children, and 60-year-old children are having trouble telling their 90-year-old parents. Then it's easier to say, look, your parents have lived 90 years. You go talk to them. They'll help you. But when you're talking about smaller children who may not have a concept or just fear about what's going to happen, that they're going to lose a parent, I think one has to sit down and share the true feelings in a safe way with hope, because I think you can always give the truth with hope. Also take away guilt that it's not their fault, because too often when you talk about stress and lifestyle, do you want your child thinking that if they got mommy upset and mommy yells at me, she's going to die? And I think it's important to clarify that the household can be difficult, that there will be moments of tension, that you as a child are not the source of that tension and that difficulties and to blame for any of this. Because I think children need to know that, or they take on a lot of responsibility. Like that lady who said her disease was a failure because her parents committed suicide and she felt like a failure as a child. So I think expressing that and then letting them see you if you're comfortable with that, in case there are any deformities or scars, even visiting in the hospital, to be aware that unspoken and unseen things are even more fearful than what's out in the open and talked about. And when it begins to be open, then we get somewhere. What I do lots of times with parents and children is say, look, go home and have your children draw the house and family. And then let's look at the drawings. And very quickly, you can see which children are doing well. For instance, if one child drew the whole thing in black, I'd say that child needs a lot of help, and maybe professional help, not just you sharing and talking. And many times, at different ages, some children won't open up. The adolescents often don't want to talk, yet they know an awful lot. Or they're angry at their mother because if my mother has breast cancer, it means I'm going to get it, and so forth. One woman was mad at her parents because she has a congenital problem in her liver, and she said, "You should never have had children, done this to me." I think all those things need to be opened and brought out. And it may have to be done in a formal therapy setting where the whole family talks, or just moments when they get together and share and talk. And also, most of all, to not stop living and laughing and having those moments that are still most important. There are two subjects that really people rarely talk about, sex and death. And it's actually, even in our groups, I'd say rather unusual for people to specifically discuss sexual problems they're having at home, even though they are. And I remember one man, just in a very touching way, what he brought up. His wife had a very distended abdomen full of fluid called ascites, and so they couldn't get close together. But he said he and his wife worked out a technique where they could hug by getting their knees together and then their shoulders and arms around each other. And when he showed she and he how they would bend and curl to fit together, it was just incredibly warm and loving. At times, when the physical act of sex is not possible, there are a lot of ways for us to still satisfy each other in a loving way, in touching, and that there are many other ways to satisfy each other sexually that are not standard traditional positions or ways that people, I think, need to discuss with each other and share. And I find that when people, again, get back to being open and discussing, there are ways of working out problems. Most importantly is the communication and the sharing. And being open, that if one is feeling guilty about something, discuss it, talk about it, say something about it. Then resolution can come. There are sex therapists now, and I was going to say there are a lot of unique ways that people have figured things out, but not to be afraid to be a little innovative in terms of how to love and how to experience sex in the midst of difficulties. Physicians often aren't the best ones to help you either. You know, we're not trained to discuss, bring up. We avoid a lot of these subjects just as everybody else does, and that's sad. But I think that if something is troubling you, bring it up. And if that individual can't help you, then find another to talk to. Because the other part that I see is that people, say with cancer, the breast or prostate or genital ovary, uterus, often avoid sex for no reason. It's a fear because the doctor didn't say it's okay. You know, it's like the old joke, when can I have sex after surgery? And you say, are you in a private room or multiple beds? They never ask, and so you don't know, and therefore leave out what is perfectly okay. And then when 6 months later you say to the doctor, and they say, well, why are you waiting? I never said, I know, but that's the problem, you never said. So ask the questions you need to ask so that you're not afraid of hurting your mate if they've had certain surgeries, and you're not afraid of your own body. One of the things that I often ask when people have had operations where you see something externally, a colostomy, a breast removed, or some other scar deformity, I often suggest to them, when you go home, have your mate change the bandage and help you with it. It forces, in a sense, touch, and it shows how that person is going to react and how much they can help you. And it's a question I frequently ask when people come back. You know, did your mate help you? Have they touched you? Have they caressed you, held you, to know what's happening at home? And I think that's very important. So, as I say, one of the ways of bringing people together can be in the post-operative care or the experience of therapy to get help there. So it creates the touch, and then there's less fear about touching and handling and doing, because we have all kinds of appliances now and external gadgets that people go home with, and it could be very scary to think, you know, I'll get tangled up in this tube and yank it out, and maybe my mate will die because I've done this or need another operation. And the more familiar you get with these things and touching and handling, and you realize there are ways to handle this and it's okay and I can do it. I believe that love heals because I look at the word healing in a very specific way. And I've said that, you know, to quote me, that I said love heals everything, but it can't cure everything. But love heals relationships. It heals lives. It allows people with afflictions, deformities, whatever you want to call them, illnesses, to go on contributing. One nurse told me that she had a patient in the intensive care unit who is totally paralyzed, on a respirator most of the day, who remembers the birthdays of all of the nurses in the intensive care unit and gets cards for them, I mean, through her family. And, I mean, people like that heal. You come in with your problems. Well, I worked with a young lady named Julie who had diabetes. She was diabetic at age 9. Heard somebody say, poor thing, she'll go blind. Said, I worried for 14 years. I went blind. It was a relief. I didn't have to worry anymore. If I would come into the office and here's this young lady with all her problems and visual problems and just beaming and giving love to the world, my troubles disappear. And so she heals me, and on her bad days, I can heal her by giving love. And the love I'm talking about is unconditional. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross defines it in a very simple way by saying it means loving with no expectations. You could read some of the work of Ashley Montague, the anthropologist, where he really lists in 2 pages what unconditional love is about. But it is the most physiologic feeling we can have. It restores you and the person you give it to. And then you know you're loving unconditionally. Because if you say, well, I loved, but then my family didn't say thank you enough, that's conditional. One of the things, matter of fact, that I remember Ashley Montague, we were at a meeting, and the room was full of doctors and nurses, and he said to them, how do you demonstrate the lack of love on an X-ray? Nobody can answer. And he finally said, I'll tell you how. When you don't love a child, the child doesn't grow. There's density in the bone. You take an X-ray of that child's bones, and you will see these lines, almost like rings in a tree. And you begin to understand that love changes you and helps you. And it affects you not only physically, but psychologically. And when you have that unconditional love, you grow as a human being, and you're capable of achieving all kinds of things, both physically and psychologically and spiritually, that you wouldn't have been able to achieve otherwise. One family I can recall, the hospice worker came out to the house and asked them why they weren't angry. And they said, because we've said all we need to say and we resolved everything. And she said, well, no, it's pathological. You're supposed to be angry. And they kept saying, but there's nothing to be angry about. And finally, they got angry at her, which made her happy. See, now you're all angry. I think when love is involved, people share their issues, finish their business, and there is a peace that can come. See, because death can be a healing, too. I mean, when you say, I'm tired and I'm sore and I'm ready to leave my body, your family understands that, and you're not a failure, and you can leave. Otherwise, what you end up doing is what most people in hospitals do, die at 2 a.m. when nobody's around. So you sneak out of your body so the doctors don't interfere and the family doesn't say, don't die, don't die. And that's sad. I see families where that message is spoken, don't die. And boy, what that does. I mean, how would you like to feel like dying and then think, I'm failing everybody because I'm doing this? Yeah, that turns into a lot of guilt and failure. But if the love is shared, if everything is spoken, then when you're tired and sore, you announce, I'm dying at 2 o'clock on Thursday when the kids get here from California, and you can do it. I often ask when somebody calls me and say, so-and-so died, I say, what time? When they say, oh, it's sunrise or sunset or 2 p.m. or some symbolic time, I know that person completed their life and the death was a healing for them. I mean, it was a moving on to something better and less uncomfortable. But when I hear the 1, 2 a.m. kind of stuff, I really feel badly that this is, you know, a sneaking away kind of thing for that person, that they have that essence of, I didn't do something right. And that's sad. And I'd say dying is not doing something wrong. It may be grief-laden, but it is something that we need to do at a certain point, and that families need to let go and understand that. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I think, coined the term unfinished business. Because often she began to do her death and dying work, people had a big part of their lives that were left unfinished. And so that was what you did to get ready to die. I also see this in the sense of people becoming hospice dropouts, that they go to hospice to die, they confront their unfinished business, finish it, and then feel too good to die and go home again. And I think any good hospice ought to have some dropouts, or they're not doing a good job. The value of the unfinished business, and really it's my whole philosophy. I'm telling people constantly, live as if you're going to die. So we don't really have to shift gears in a sense, except in a medical sense, that you may be saying, fine, I'm living as if I'm going to die, and then one day you say to me, I'm ready. I want to stop active medical therapy. I say, okay, but I don't want you to change how you've been living philosophically. I still want you to live as if you're going to die. What else may you need to finish? What do you need to share? What do you need to talk about? Let's get the family in and do that. And then very frequently say, you know, I got the whole family in, I did all that, now I feel too good to die. And I see this with many, many people, that literally their last night on earth, who are spending lots of time worrying about everybody else. When you get them to let go of those worries, finish, give the responsibility back to other people, have a big breakfast the next morning, and go on living, because it's an incredible unburdening. It's really like carrying 10,000 pounds on your shoulders all the time. And so finishing your unfinished business says, I'm dumping this load, letting things roll off my shoulders, and now I don't have to carry that burden. I can just think of myself, not in a selfish way, but my joy, my living in the moment, my functioning in that way now, rather than carrying everybody's responsibility. And that is physiologic. It can help you physically. It certainly helps you psychologically and lets you go in peace, lets you complete your life. I'd hate to die without, as I said, having lived or completing my life. And you can complete your life in 5 minutes, and I mean that literally, because I see people doing that sometimes. And those last 5 minutes can be incredibly powerful when it allows the love in as well as to be expressed. I can remember one lady in the hospital who, after her surgery, a respiratory therapist came in, and she said, in the midst of this cloud of vapor and steam, he leaned over and said, your life is going to be an adventure from here on. And I think that has helped save this lady many, many times, because her life has been a rather traumatic adventure. But if you look at your life as a novel, you kind of say, well, let's see what the next chapter is, and I make it through. Or another lady who said, I heard somebody say, depressions always end. And so whenever I get depressed, I know it's going to end. And it's little words like that from one friend to another that can often keep you going and turn you around. Others are literally hearing, as I've said many times, that you're going to die. And then you say, well, then I refuse to live this way anymore, and go out into the world and are not afraid to speak up, participate, and do a whole host of things. So the lady who was close to death one night said, my kids, I don't like where they go at night. My husband doesn't even make out the checks for the electric bill now that I'm sick. And I said, you know, your last night on earth, that's what you're going to spend your night worrying about? Next morning when I made rounds, was up and awake eating this great big breakfast. I said, what's going on? She said, I took your advice. I let go of them. And those kinds of things can be the turning points. But don't wait, is all I can keep saying, till you're almost dead to suddenly enjoy the day. Do it now. Don't wait, because we are all mortal. Another lady I think about, who walked around the hospital, who kept saying to me, oh, it's fine for you to walk around saying you never know who's going to die when, but I have leukemia. Next day I came around, she said, you know, look in the paper. Her next door neighbor was killed in an airplane crash. She said, you know, you're right. We don't know the future. I'm going to get up and live. And those are the things that can turn people around. But don't wait to get hit in the head with a mallet. Learn from somebody else's hit in the head, because you are a member of the species. You are vulnerable. You can't live without troubles. That have to keep repeating. And if you're going to live, then use the troubles to turn you around and redirect you. One social worker who developed cancer wrote a letter. In the letter, he put the names of everybody who received the letter and told them to have a meeting, get together, and figure out when to visit him and how to help him and how to give him rides so they didn't all show up Sunday afternoon. It is sharing. You'd be amazed at how much love is there if you let people know. I think when you use what one lady called her secret technique, you destroy yourself. She told her husband not to tell anybody, her kids not to tell anybody. She went to affairs and reunions. Nobody knew, and there was to be no obituary. And I really had to laughingly say, what's going to happen when you die? Is your husband going to prop you up in the living room window? I mean, how can you keep it a secret when you're dead? But she was destroying herself with that energy. And I'd say, share. If people can't share, they won't come back. You don't need those kinds of people. If you're not afraid, however, ultimately they do come back, because if you show them how to live with adversity, they'd learn from you, and they come back and say, I need to learn from you because of what you're doing in the face of your disease. It is paying again attention to your feelings so that you set up your life in a way that feels right for you, nutritionally, psychologically, get help, reach out for all those things. I've made a list based on what patients have said of five things, and it was to keep a journal of your feelings and dreams, to join a group that meets for a couple of hours every week to support you and keep you from being a victim and giving you loving confrontation, to meditate 4 to 6 times a day, to live an hour at a time based on feelings, so you don't deal with feelings you don't like, and the self-love aspect from sitting naked or standing naked in front of a mirror for 15 minutes twice a day to deal with the feelings about yourself. I think that will work on you. You should suggest everybody in your family does the same thing too. But from the letters I see of families and individuals, I think it's most of all the sharing and the speaking out and making everybody part of your team. Not being afraid to let them know how to help you and not being afraid to ask. We see people come to our group meetings and let's say their car breaks down and they need to ask a friend. They're very embarrassed, but finally they ask for a ride. On the way there, the friend tells them all her troubles and that she has cancer too. And then lo and behold, the person who's originally coming stops coming and the driver says, well, I need to keep coming. We all need it. And when you share it with people, you'll be amazed at the support you get. Well, let me just tell you a simple story. Because all these healings doesn't mean that somebody got totally well and went on. And just on simple terms, a lady called me in my hotel room. We were doing a workshop in Boston. Her family did. And said, please call Penny at the hospital. She's there to die. So I called the hospital. And this feeble voice answers and says, yes, I'm here to die. And we spent half an hour talking about how to make the transition into death easier. I told her I'd call her back after the weekend. Well, I call the same number Monday and Tuesday, and I get no answer. My assumption is she's dead or in intensive care or who knows what. Wednesday, there's her name and a new phone number on my desk. So I call the new number, and this nice, vigorous voice says, hello. I said, excuse me, I'm looking for Penny. He says, it's me. I said, what happened? She said, well, Friday night you called me. I hung up the phone, she said, and I thought to myself, that guy's so busy. He spent a half an hour with me. How could I die? So I got up and went home. I think those are the things that happen in people's lives. They make a shift. They say, I'm not going to die. Now, I know that there are a lot of people who are dead today who would like to be alive, but under better conditions. See, 2 or 3 months later, after she completed some wonderful trips and things with her family, she could say, you know, I'm tired and I'm sore and I'm ready to go. She didn't call me up to keep her from dying again. She said, I'm tired and I'm sore. And her husband thanked me and she let go. She completed her life. And so the dying isn't the failure. And if people call me and say, well, my cousin, my wife, my husband, they really loved and they wanted to live and you're making me feel awful and guilty and I don't have the right attitude, I say, you're mixing up my message. The message is heal your life. You may have some wonderful byproducts, but we're not trying to keep everybody from being dead. I can't. And I think this is something Penny knew and lots of others know. They straighten their lives out. They get a benefit. And so do the survivors, because that's one of the most important things. What is the gift you leave for those who come after you? And if we don't feel guilty, if we have lived our life, it doesn't mean it's not sad to go. I'm not going to be happy to die. There are a lot of things I'd like to watch and see. But at the same time, I'll find it a lot easier because I have shared love. I have contributed something. I have done some things that are real. And I can say, all right, I'm going to go. My body isn't useful. It's sore. I can't accomplish what I want. That, again, is a personal judgment. As I said, one man says, I'm quadriplegic. I want to die. Another one says, I'm quadriplegic. Get me art lessons. So it's an individual choice. And I will always try to help people find ways to live meaningfully. But when you reach an ultimate point at which you say, hey, this is no fun living in this thing anymore. I've got to go. Then I think we have to let go and let that person die surrounded by love. What are some of the other sides of the coin? A friend of ours who works at a hospice said he went to a home. Father was there to die. Everybody's surrounding the father. And the family said, you know, we don't know what you say or do at a moment like this. And he said, why don't you talk about your father's life? The man had been quite a character, apparently. So as the kids began to tell anecdotes about his life, it got funny. And the whole family started chuckling. They looked down. Lo and behold, Dad is laughing, too, and died laughing. That is something, you see, that was a gift to that whole family, that their father could die with a smile on his face because of what he contributed to that family and what they gave back to him at that moment. And I might tell you one other anecdote at the same time. A gentleman who was actually looking forward to dying because he said, oh, I'll be in heaven to meet Jesus. I can't wait to die. I can't wait. One night in the intensive care unit, the physician came in, the family's around the bed, and he announced to the family, because the man was so ill he didn't even think he could hear him. He said, your father's not going to make it through the night. He's going to die tonight. The man heard, became so overjoyed that he got well. He has responded 3 times to the announcement that he was going to die that night by getting better, because he became so overjoyed with the thought of going to heaven and meeting Jesus that he recovered. And my comment is, if that man's going to die, it's going to have to be a secret from him, because we cannot tell him, or he'll get better. I, years ago, kept a journal of my feelings when I was unhappy as a physician. I did it intuitively. Now I know it's good advice. And in the journal, I can remember writing once, why do people keep dying in the wee hours of the morning? Here you are as an intern resident, you're in the hospital, you're exhausted, you're trying to get some rest, and invariably at 1, 2, 3 in the morning, the nurse calls you to say, Mr. Smith just died, can you come down and pronounce him dead? And I wrote down one day, why can't the dying be more respectful of the living? They could die at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning when I'm already making rounds, it'd be so much easier. It took me about 20 years to understand that, because I can still go anywhere in this country, or planet for that matter, and say, if you don't think people have control over their dying, then tell me when people die in your hospital. Everybody always answers in the wee hours of the morning for the majority of cases. And I think what that demonstrates are 2 things. One is that people know that if you try dying at noon in a hospital, it isn't going to be easy. A lot of people are going to rush in and stop you because it represents failure. And the other side of the coin is that if you want to leave without making your family feel upset, you die at those hours. Because the family then is usually gone home, fallen asleep, and there's no guilt involved. I'm sneaking out of here. Nobody can say, stop, don't leave, don't die. Now, how do you see that in positive ways? You see people, like one wonderful Jewish mother we had, and I said to the family, your mother's not going to die with you in the room. She wouldn't do that to her kids. One night, 6 o'clock, just before the cafeteria closed at the hospital, the mother said, you all go get supper. Cafeteria's going to close. They all got up and went for supper. 5 minutes later, the mother died. What did they understand? Her last act was a gift to them. Go fill your stomachs. I'm taking care of you even with my last act, and then I die. Another woman called me and said, I'm with my mother 4 days. You say dying's easy. Why hasn't she died? I say, I know your mother. Step out in the hallway. She walks out in the hallway. Her mother died 15 minutes later. Now, if she'd gone home for a shower, because her comment was, I've been with my mother 4 days, I smell, I haven't left her side. She'd gone home to take a shower, she would be the guiltiest daughter in the world. I went home to take a shower, and that's why my mother died. Oh, if I stayed another day. If you stay another day, your mother waits. So I see this interaction all the time. One item that I think we need to look at is there are times where you feel ready to let go, but your family isn't ready to let go of you. And this isn't always something that you can undertake as a burden. I mean, you can choose to not die, which I can tell you symbolically, one drawing. A lady drew a purple kite floating up in the sky. That was her way of saying, I'm ready to go. But interestingly enough, her husband was hanging on to the kite. And she realized that when they got married many, many years ago, because she was a nurse, look, honey, the husband said, I'll die first and you'll take care of me. And then, boom, she's the one who's sick. So she looked at the drawing and said, well, I can't die. He isn't ready to let go. Now, that was her choice, you see. She didn't say, I'll have to keep on dying. She said, look, he isn't ready. I won't die. 7 months later, he said, honey, I cut the string. If you're ready to go, it's okay. And she said, literally, I'll die Thursday at 2 o'clock when the kids get here from California, which she did. She never lost her sense of humor because that morning she said to me, you know, the kids are coming. Supposing I change my mind and decide not to die, you think they're going to be angry? Also, I said to her, now that you've decided to die, do you have any questions, anything I can help you with about dying? And she laughed. I said, you know, what's funny about what I asked you? She said, I've never died before. How do I know what questions to ask? And I think these are people who are living their whole lives. And she was never dying. And that's something that I think if you are never dying, see, my definition is back to you're alive or dead, not living or dying. If she was never dying, then she will teach her family something. A woman who died, the announcement came over the hospital loudspeaker, visiting hours are over, and she died at that moment. And another is a little boy who one night, with thunder and lightning, his father happened to be a minister, he yelled, Daddy, I'm afraid, and the father came in and said, don't worry, God will help you. And he said, yeah, but sometimes I need God with skin on. And I think that's what's lost when somebody dies. The touch, the skin, the visiting hours are gone. And you have to understand that it is appropriate for a family to grieve and to show that grief. You're losing someone you love. Let them express that. Don't ask them to keep smiling and saying, I'm fine and I'll be okay. But I think we need to share this. Let go. Each person's feelings are their feelings. But if you say, I have loved and I have shared love, I guarantee the love will stay with you. And I have to share, it's hard for me to stop when I start in this area, of a man who sent me a poem called In Our Daughter's Eyes. And he said he wrote this 6 years ago, didn't know what to do with it until he came across me in my writing and mailed it to me. It's called In Our Daughter's Eyes. And the wife said, honey, look for me in our daughter's eyes. I'll always be there. It's hard for me not to be emotional every time I read or talk about this poem. He, one night, was in the poem putting his daughter to bed, and it's written beautifully, and looked in his daughter's eyes and saw his wife and just began in this reverie of his wife. And when he was done with the reverie, he opens his eyes again, looks down, and his daughter's all tucked in. And she said, don't worry, Daddy, Mommy tucked me in. Those things happen in our lives, and people experience them. And when you understand that, you understand the statement that came of a Norwegian woman, Sigrid Undset, who talks about men dying for thousands of years. But amongst all those, there had been a few about whom their loved ones have said, few better will come after, and then they went on living. If you take those last two sentences, you understand what you're doing for others. Few better will come after. If that can be said about you, all well and good. I hope it's my epitaph. But the next sentence more important. And then they went on living, you see. So when you have lived and loved and are gone, what does your family do? Say, oh, this is awful. We all have to commit suicide. We all have to stop living. Look at this pain. No, they say, you know what we're going to do? We go right on living because that's what Dad did or our child did. It doesn't matter what the age is. Because I know a 9-year-old in Minnesota who had hundreds of people at his funeral releasing purple balloons and singing his favorite songs. And they will go on living because of that 9-year-old and what he did with his adversity. And that's why the age is irrelevant. It's what we give to each other. And that 9-year-old's parents are going to go on because of how he lived, you see. Then I meet parents who also say, oh, my God, look, here's an A in English in fourth grade, and God took my child. And they spend the rest of their lives mad at God and everybody else and carrying around a fourth grade composition. Instead of saying, how can I love the world? How can I use the loss? How can I start an organization for other parents going through this pain? And then beauty comes out of that. And so few better will come after, and then they went on living. And I think that's the important part. In order for someone to die peacefully, I think there are certain conditions that have to be met, but the ultimate one is obviously it has to be your life. Making rounds with the students the other day, came on the ward, I said to the nurse, what happened to Mr. Smith? And the nurse said, oh, he died. And then I said to the nurse, what time did he die? And she said, 1 a.m. And I turned to the student and I said, he had to die at 1 a.m. And the nurse said, what do you mean he had to? I said, because I know his wife, and for the last week she's been saying to him, you can't die, don't die, you can't die. When's he going to sneak away? You know, when his wife's home at 1 o'clock, so he hasn't let her down. Other things that family members do is, you know, you have a diagnosis, and then the family says, you must go through an operation, chemotherapy, radiation, you can't die. Oh, that's a burden, too. Because I don't want to go through all that for somebody else. If I want to do it for me, I'll do it for me. And I think you have to take charge of your life so that you can have it as your life and make your decisions. And say to your family that this is me, my life. I want to contribute what I can contribute. And when I'm tired and sore, I've got to go and you have to let go of me. You can also help sustain them, you know, teach them, let them be part of that process so that they have something and that they learn that they can go on and that they are strong enough. You know, some of it on a practical level, maybe turning things over that say you have to write checks, pay bills, you know, go shopping, learn how to drive. You're capable of living and help them do that. And you may decide to be around until they can do that. But ultimately, we get back to you, it's your life. You see, when you take charge of fighting for your life, dying is easy because you turn off all of the things you had turned on, and then you say, goodbye. It's you that's doing it, and that makes it okay. And that there's no guilt, which, again, if you've been brought up on guilt, it's going to be tough, but, you know, it's something you have to deal with and look at. When a person is at peace, their dying is a lot different. Let me tell you a couple of stories. I was walking down the hall of the hospital one night, and a man grabbed me and said, come on in. My wife's here to die. She's been an exceptional patient. If you would just whisper a few words in her ear, she's in coma. And so I went in the room, and I whispered in her ear that if you need to go, it's okay. We love you. you have to understand this, that there may be people listening who say, gee, I don't want to whisper to a loved one. If you need to go, it's okay. Your love will stay with us. The point is, if they don't want to go, they don't go. So you're not saying die. You're saying it's okay to die. We'll miss you, but we can go on with your love. Well, the next day I came back, and the woman's awake. And she said, I don't want to die. I said, what's your disease like? She said, oh, it's an obstruction. I said, why don't you deal with all the obstructions in your life? Let's see what happens. 5 days later, I got a chance to get back to the floor, and I walk into that room, bed's empty, nice-looking lady sitting by the window, and I said, excuse me, where is Sharon? She said, it's me. I'm going home today. And I would say to you that she took care of the obstructions in her life and also was healed physically, see? Now, 9 months later, that lady's still alive. And I think that comes out of that simple sharing. I also got called by a daughter who said, my mother does want to die and is having trouble dying, and we don't understand what's going on. So I come to visit, and I walk in, and the woman says, yes, I definitely want to die, and the phone rings while I'm sitting there on the bed. So she picks up the phone, says, oh, excuse me, my grandchildren are coming, swings her feet over, goes to the closet in the hospital room, puts on her clothes, gown, makeup, looks terrific, and I said, I know why you're having trouble dying. She said, why? I said, because if you're dead, how are you going to be a perfect grandmother and entertain your grandchildren? And I kept visiting her for a few weeks, going through, trying to get her to understand that to die, she needed to let go. You cannot be a perfect wife, mother, and grandmother and be dead at the same time. I mean, it just doesn't work. And again, I'm sitting on her bed one day, the phone rings. Don't answer the phone. If you are trying to die, you don't have to answer the phone. Of course, she picks it up, talks for about 15 minutes without saying the doctor's here, you know, call me back, and then hands me the phone. It's her daughter, and we talk and hang up again. A few more minutes go by, I talk, phone rings again. Her hand goes out, and I say, don't answer. Hand comes back. And it's up and back thing for about 4 times. And finally, her hand plops on the phone. I said, look, I've got to explain something to you. I really have to leave now, but that phone call is a wrong number sent by God to teach you something. Picks up the phone, it's a wrong number. And within a day, she had died. And I think that wrong number taught her something, you see. And that's, again, what I'm saying to people. You want to die at peace? Then fulfill your obligations and your life and let go. I mean, when you're dead, you can't fill all these roles. You want to die at peace? Finish your business. Let go. Withdraw. Allow people to go on. Separate. Detach. Whatever words you want to use. But stop. Because when you realize that you can't stop answering a phone call at the moment that you're trying to die, you realize the absurdity that people carry this extreme to. We've had people even disconnect their phones. I mean, literally take it out of the house because they felt guilty not saving the world even when they're sick. And once they learn that the world just continues on, even without that telephone, they can have it reinstalled, not have to answer or take it off the hook. And I'd say think about that symbolically. You're not on call for the world. And when you want to let go and die at peace, take the phone off the hook and let go. Mother yourself, father yourself, let the child in you grow and live your life. That's what it's all about. Symbolically, I have to tell you 2 stories. One talks about God saying to Jeremiah, go down and watch the potter. And Jeremiah goes down and watches the potter shape the clay. And sometimes he makes a shape and doesn't like it. He takes it, moistens it, makes a glob again, slaps it down on the wheel, and works. And there are wide bowls and narrow-necked urns, and we come in all shapes and sizes, and we're all different, but all beautiful. But as he watched the potter, he began to realize what God is telling us, that God isn't through with us at any time. And that sometimes you have to reshape it and work again, but the message is, the only sin is to not try. And that's the only sin that God is really trying to share with us. So be like the potter, keep trying, keep working, and you're accomplishing something. The Indians have a wonderful saying, when you were born, you cried, and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a manner that when you die, the world cries, and you rejoice. Several years ago in the fall, I looked around, and I looked at the gorgeous colors, varieties, and shapes. And I really have to answer for people in the hospital, why am I different? So you talk to a teenager who says, I'm dying, and why am I different? And you better have an answer for him if you're going to be honest. So I have to think. And so I go to God, and I said, God, I would like to know why you made this variety and all these patterns and colors in the fall. And God said, you know, I'm having a very busy day today. Would you go work on it? And I would just forewarn all of you that if you get to God when she's having a busy day, don't intrude, because the lightning and thunder gets scary. So I left, and I worked at it. And I came back 2 weeks later, and I said, God, I think I have an answer. She said, what is it? I said, well, what I noticed was last spring that when the leaves come out, they're a little different and different colors. And I thought, let me just sort of be a maple leaf and see what it feels like. And I thought, okay, I'm a maple leaf and I'm coming out and I'm deciding what I want to be like, what I want to look like, what color, what shape. And I suddenly hear a voice, this is a maple tree. You have to be green and you have a certain shape and you have to fit in, because we are not going to have people walk by this tree and say, what a funny tree, look at that leaf. So you do what everybody else is doing. You are a maple leaf. It's spring and it's summer. You don't mind being a maple leaf. Then the fall comes and gets a little chilly. And what do you notice? Some of the guys who told you to be a maple leaf have already dropped from the tree. And more are dropping around you. And you think to yourself, obviously I can't hang on to the tree of life forever. And if I can't hang on to the tree of life forever, then I'm going to be myself for a time before I die. And so you get rid of the green, which is a cover-up. You allow your true colors and your true patterns to appear. Your unique beauty comes out, and every leaf on that tree is different and individual and beautiful. And you don't let go of the tree of life until you have lived your life and shown your beauty. Then you hang on as long as you want. Because my comment also is, in January, you'll see some scrawny, dried-up leaves hanging on. And if you walk the streets, you'll see some scrawny, dried-up people hanging on. But that's an individual choice. So hang on as long as you want. But don't let go of the tree of life until you have lived your life. Even if it's for a moment, at least you've had that moment, then you can let go.